In a response to a Newsweek poll of December 2004, 55% of U.S. citizens sampled in a random survey, including 83% of all evangelical Protestants, indicated that they believe literally in the accuracy of every word of the Bible. 2 years earlier, 2002, in a CNN Time magazine poll, 59% of all Christians and 77% of all fundamentalists and evangelicals replied yes to the question, will the events in the book of Revelations occur in the future or not? When asked by Newsweek in October of 1999 whether the world will end in an Armageddon battle between Jesus and the Antichrist, 45% of all Christians and 71% of all evangelical Protestants answered affirmatively. Kevin Phillips has recently authored a book called American Theocracy, where he's worried about the American drift, and he compares America with Canada, European and Australian countries, and really suggests that America and its religious mentalities back in the 17th century. In what follows, I read the unprecedented popularity of the Left's To Behind series is symptomatic of a unique American historical coupling of otherworldly religious beliefs and long-standing desires to blast technologically free of the flesh. This technological blast-off suppresses or disavows the reality of our systemic human-animal interconnections with living energetic matter. Left behind is the possibility of a more mindful material spiritual attention to the realities of our global historical positioning within the general economy of life itself. Reverence for our energetic relations to each other and to the rest of the natural historical world. This is a short sociological story of dominant aspects of U.S. culture's fateful religious and technological flight from the flesh. It focuses on the Left Behind novels because the popular or populist religious imagination of these novels, I think, is a clue to aspects of America's cultural vision of itself as a transcendent force for good in a relentless global struggle against evil. Section 2, After the Rapture. In Left Behind, the rapture is followed by the mercurial rise of the Antichrist. Over the course of Christian history, though occasionally a symbol of internal spiritual decay, mostly the Antichrist represents an external persona, whether individual or collective, that somehow true believers have to fight against. Deceptive, destructive, seductive, these are all words used about the Antichrist. In our own time, it's primarily fundamentalist Protestants that make this a main figure of their religious belief. In the Left Behind series, the Antichrist is both charismatic and humble. Secular reason and science are the great deceiver's calling cards. Shortly after first appearing in the narrative, the Antichrist arranges for peace between Israel and its neighbors. Then things get really bad. This is a prophetic sign of the ends of time when Israel and Palestine and its neighbors come into peace. It seems like it would be a good sign, but for American Christians, it's really a sign of end times. The peace covenant is really a prophetic door into the tribulation. 7 catastrophic years of terror, war, devastating storms, earthquakes, floods, famines, disease, unprecedented suffering, all under the sign of the wrath of the Lamb. As the novels progress, 3/4 of the human population dies in terrible ways. These are really bloody novels. Backed by one of the world's most powerful financiers, Nikolai Jetty Kaparthia, the mesmerizing Antichrist, rules over the world during the days of tribulation. Nikolai is an entrepreneurial businessman, a political liberal, an advocate for global disarmament and peace. In a flash, he's named the president of Romania. About a week later, he's asked to address the General Assembly of the UN. His speech is so captivating, and he gives such a detailed knowledge of UN history, he's immediately proclaimed Secretary General, kind of wild event, but quickly changes the name of the position to World Potentate. Under the leadership of the World Potentate, the UN morphs and changes its name into a global community and establishes a one-world government and relocates itself in Iraq. The center of the one world government. The fully pacified Iraq, believe me. The seductive Antichrist, he speaks 9 language. He's pictured this way, quote, an inch or two over 6 feet tall, broad-shouldered, thick-chested, trimmed, athletic, tan, and blonde. He's pictured as a young Robert Redford. He's so handsome, and People magazine names him the sexiest man alive. He's also a skilled hypnotist, able to actually erase memories of collective historical events, as well as implant false memories in people that fall into allegiance with him. And soon, in the name of peace, he's dropping bombs all over the world, only to be opposed by underground U.S. militia, an underground network of Christian resistors, who really set up cells, much like Al-Qaeda, to fight the U.N. And the Antichrist, or the global community. He's got wild helpers, just going to move through this quickly, name a few of them. One is called, it was former Archbishop of Cincinnati, Ohio, Peter Matthews, whose name changes to Pontifex Maximus. Much of this is modeled on the Roman Empire. And he helps establish Enigma Babylon, which is a one-world religion that'll match the one-world government and one-world economy that's being put into place. He is also a head of public relations, Leon Fortunato, who's called the false prophet. And then Viv Evans, she helps, she's a technological whiz also, and she helps implant identity microchips under the skin of every citizen of the global community. And these resonate with these kind of biblical notions of the mark of the beast. So I know this is serious consideration in the U.S. of having us all have electronic microchips with us, but this is actually going on in these novels. To combat the alluring force of the Antichrist, the tribulation force, forms a bunch of safe houses and underground networks and really kind of act as terrorists fighting back against the forces of the global community. Rayford and Buck become double agents. Rayford accepts a job. He's the pilot of Carpathia's Global Community One airplane, which is a pale thing like the U.S. One for airplane that the President Bush has. The journalist Buck Williams, he becomes the head of the new one. There's only one newspaper in the world now because all the papers are bought up by the Antichrist. They buy up the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, and they formed the Global Community Weekly. He edits that now. It's interesting that you can expect this in some ways. The tribulation force is multi-ethnic and prominent Jewish rabbi scholar. The rabbi Zion ben Yehuda, he's been doing a three-year study that comes right into the finishing, right in the opening pages of the novels here, to determine whether Jesus Christ was the true Messiah, and he finds out he was. So he switches from being Jewish to being Christian, and he sets up internet broadcasts all over the world and so forth. So all this stuff is going on. Amazing things happen in the courses of the novels. The Antichrist, Carpathia, is giving a speech, and he's assassinated by one of these terrorist hit squads, these militias, and so forth. But he's resurrected immediately on CNN, which is a dramatic event, which a lot of people really believe just how powerful he is. Dead one moment, live another. But this is really like pseudo-Christ. This is the way the Christ was resurrected. This is the only way the Antichrist is resurrected. It's really not even him anymore. It's Satan indwelling his personality. So he looks like Nikolai, but really now it's Satan. Finally, the whole thing in volume 12 comes to an end with Jesus' return. And for those who study the Bible and think of Jesus as a figure of love and turn your cheek, and say this isn't the Jesus that appears in these novels. It's Jesus the Christ and destroyer, the warrior king. He comes down to the fabled Mount of Olives and he opens fire with his words. His word is the primary technology, which I just find interesting allegorically. When he opens his mouth, it's like a laser beam weapon, and it burst open the bodies of the global community army. The siege was deafening as the global community army is about to attack Jerusalem. All the weapons are in place. Jet engines, jeeps, cars, trucks, Hummers, transports, armaments, munitions, rifle fire, machine gun fire, you name it. But suddenly, a dense and technologically disabling darkness surrounds the forces, and none of the technology works. The only sound was the clicking of weapons that would not fire. Nothing produced lights, no headlights, no matches, no lighters, no nothing, really. Perched atop the Humvee, the blazing Antichrist is incensed. Light, screeches Carpathia! But everything was dark. Fire, he rages, and yet nothing happens. And all of a sudden, the clouds roll back, and like a scroll from horizon to horizon, Jesus makes his entrance riding a white horse. Jesus Christ's eyes shone with the conviction of fire. and he held up his majestic head high. And again, soon he opens his mouth and the bodies of the soldiers burst open, and the global army rattles its sabers, but all there is left, the corpses are left everywhere and they're burnt. It's a very gory scene. Part three, apocalyptic technologies of control and resistance. The use of technology to command, control, and communicate is pervasive throughout the Left Behind novels. Much of what takes place in the novels, the advancement of the plot, which is quite clever, takes place through various forms of telecommunication. Cellular, satellite phones, video conferencing, internet, all this kind of stuff, answering machines. And this is, in some ways, the way the plot goes. And the Antichrist forces are really deeply technological. There's surveillance everywhere. If you think that Britain's under video camera surveillance, I mean, the whole world becomes this way here. Also, the technology of the Antichrist allows him to intercept. He can intercept this message right here and substitute his own words for mine. I mean, this is going on all the time, technological control of communications is the main thing. The Antichrist is lecturing his followers. He says, all banking, all commerce, religion, and government will start and end right here with communications. The greatest challenge in the world is mastering communications. We're already beginning to build an international network. Now, Rayford, the pilot, who's now a mole in the inner circle of the global community, interrupts and says, wait a minute, are you saying that communications is more important than people? More important than cleaning up the areas of the world where disease occurs? More important than reuniting families? And Nikolai responds in this way, in due time, Captain Steele. Such efforts all depend on communications, too. Fortunately, the timing of my most ambitious project yet could not be more propitious. The global community recently secured sole ownership of all satellite and cellular communication companies. Within a few months, we'll set up Cellular Global. And so that whenever he goes on and explains how they're going to really do it again, it'd be one system of communications, and there'll be one system of distorted language in a way that's reminiscent of Orwell. The word peace becomes equivalent to war, a freedom constraint, reason blind obedience, religion becomes equal to secularity, and community equals the worship of the ego. So all this goes on, and to counter it, it's not only these communications, there's also in almost a kind of Baudrillard world, a fascination with images that they make a simulacra of the potentate that's put in all world capitals everywhere. It's an exact replica of Carpathia. Television is used to broadcast all kinds of stuff. Because I'm moving quickly and I want to read to you the last section. I don't want to take up more time than was allotted to me. There's a long section where the Rabbi Ben Yehuda talks about what's on television, and he talks about his like black magic and sexuality and nudity and sensuality is captivating everybody, is making us all feel unclean. And it's interesting to me as I went and researched the non-fictional writings of LaHaye and Jenkins, and they have almost exactly the same passage in this book called Are We Living at End Times, where they're talking about the same stories, topless dancers and television and adult entertainment and the addiction to immorality, the cesspool of communications. But it's within this cesspool that the global community finds that it's being fought back by the Tribulation Force. The Tribulation Force do a whole lot of high-tech stuff. Rayford is able to plant the tech device inside the cockpit. He's in the cockpit, but he puts it inside the cabin of the Global One airplane so he can listen into Carpathia and his henchmen talk about their plans for world domination. And this multicultural technology force, Chang Wong, a member of the Tribulation Force, he's expert at all kinds of computer designs, and he's able to put a global video monitor inside the headquarters of global community so that the people who are hiding in the caves, it's interesting, Al-Qaeda's hiding in the caves, the Christians are hiding in caves, and they have big screen TVs in there, and they can watch the maneuvers of the global community, and the global community thinks that they're in private and so forth, so maybe Al-Qaeda has those, they're watching Bush. But these parallels are disturbing in lots of ways. Harvesting new souls. I know Arthur Croker, following Heidegger, often uses the language of harvesting in relation to thinking of the demonic potential of technology. These technologies are used to harvest souls. The Soul Harvest is the name of one of the books. But the technology is clearly bivalent here. It's a demonic and redemptive. This redemptive side could surprise some people, particularly in the U.S., who think that the technology is fully being opposed by Christians who oppose the stem cell research, or say that evolution didn't happen and all this kind of stuff. There's always been, I think, as David Noble, The Religion of Technology, a really important short book by David Noble shows, that there's always been this disembodied, transcendental desire to get beyond the flesh in Western technology. This, I think, is a big aspect of what's going on in these novels. Glenn Schuck, who's written on these books, also talks about that in some sense, LaHaye and Jenkins come close to almost deifying technology as a strategy of redemption. And one of Schuck's criticisms is that technology, even when it's its best, always sacrifices or leaves something out. It always has a tragic dimension. It directs attention in some ways but not others. The lack of tragic awareness is one of his criticisms of the book. And I want to end in my last section by talking about this lack of tragic awareness in this kind of, in some sense, glorification of the redemptive value of transcendental technology. To do that, I want to meditate on this passage that is very near the end of the 12 novels. And when Jesus has now destroyed all the bodies, burst open the flesh of the global community army, finally his word turns upon Satan itself. And he brings Satan out of the body of Carpathia. And the word is such a powerful technology that Satan has to change form. He changes from a lion to a titanic hissing serpent. The angel Gabriel appears and says this, "Lucifer, dragon, serpent, devil, Satan, you will now face the one you have opposed from time immemorial." Then Jesus orders Satan to kneel at his feet. "I have fought against you from shortly after your creation," said Jesus. "My creation? I was no more created than you were. And who are you to have anything against me?" says Satan. "You be silent," says Jesus. The angel of light appears, and Jesus continues, "For all your lies about having evolved, you are nothing but a created being." Then the creature violently shakes his head, but Jesus continues, "Only God has the power to create, and you were our creation. You were in Eden, the garden of God, before it was a paradise for Adam and Eve. You were there as an exalted servant when Eden was nothing but a beautiful rock garden. You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You defiled your sanctuaries by the multitude of your iniquities, and you got Eve into sinning. During the next millennium, then, you attempted to pollute the whole bloodline of mankind through Adam. I lay at your feet all the suffering of mankind. The earth was once a utopia, yet you brought sin into it, and the result was poverty, disease, more than 15,000 wars, and the senseless killing of millions." The last section, in the beginning. The treacherous figure of the serpent in the opening pages of Genesis and the closing pages of Left Behind, the exalted servant of the Word, who sins by imagining itself as evolving alongside the Word in history, represented something else entirely to the neighboring peoples of Mesopotamia, against whom the monotheistic peoples of the Word distinguished themselves. For other so-called pagan or animist peoples of Mesopotamia, human existence came into being as a gift of nature, and the serpent was a symbol of the divine gift-giver, the Great Mother. Nature, the cosmic serpent that gave birth to the world, was revered as a source of all life, the womb of life, the energetic web of human materiality, or of natural materiality from which humans came and to which we returned. All of creation, including human-animal creation, was believed to owe its life to the sacred serpent, the matrix of life in which all humans, animals, rocks, minerals participate. The snake was the first symbol of eternal life, and like the moon, it continued to change. Each time shedding its skin, it was reborn. It represented cosmic continuity between humans and nature, between technology and matter, spiritual continuity within the changes of material life. This, of course, is not at all how either the Bible or the Left Behind novels imagines the story. In these stories, things are in reverse. The Bible recognizes no great mother of life, no sacred materiality, no sacred serpent from which we come and to which we go. For the Bible, the serpent's pictured as evil and envious of the Word. According to the Bible, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things came into being. Not one thing came into being except through him. This is what distinguishes the people of the Bible from the animists they had once been and from their neighbors. The Bible denies the sacredness of living energetic matter and serpentine ways of the flesh. People of the Bible, people of the Word, rely on orderly transcendental technologies of the Word in their battle against the chaotic forces of evil. They make use of everything in sight to glorify the Word's triumph over time in the mortal flesh. The people of the Word, no longer believe that life comes into being as a maternal gift of nature for better and for worse. For them, life comes only from the Word. In the beginning, they say, God created heaven and earth by speaking. Before God spoke, the earth was a formless void, and there was darkness over the deep. Then God's mouth came and opened, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God said, let there be a vault through the middle of the waters to divide one water from the other. And so it was. And God spoke again, and dry earth came into being. He spoke again, and seed-bearing plants and lights in the sky and every kind of creature. Then God said, let us make man in our own image and likeness, and let them be masters of the fish of the sea, the birds of heaven, the cattle and wild animals, and all creatures that creep along the ground. The serpent creeps along the ground. God made man master of the serpent and gave him dominion over the rest of creation as well. And to facilitate man's mastery, God gave man the power of naming, the power of using words, and whatever man called each living creature, that would be its name. Next would come famine, death, and plagues until a quarter of the earth's population that remained after the rapture was wiped out. Rayford's cell phone, universal cell phone, was vibrating in his pocket. Rayford said, thank God for technology. None of this is exactly true. Despite the strong biblical words about these matters, we humans are truly never really physically at a world's or a word's distance from nature, naming nature from above. We are instead situated within the relational fluxes of living energetic matter, an immanent aspect of nature's own history. Traces of this awareness, long suppressed by those who adhere to the literalness of the Bible, are revealed in the etymology of words used in the Bible itself. In Genesis, the term for formless void that's brought into order by God's word, the terms in ancient Hebrew are towa, ba, wohu. This term is related to the ancient term Tehom, a term associated with the ancient Mesopotamian serpent goddess Tiamat. The name given by Adam, he names her, the first woman, Eve, also carries resonance of the ancient serpent's goddess. The Hebrew word for Eve is Hawa, which means mother of the living. To follow the serpentine path of words, the meaning of which has become distorted in literal interpretations of the Bible and its technologies, is not to preach the gospel of secular humanism so virulently opposed by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins. A one-world religion is one-world secularism. It is instead to reconnect, literally, to a more holistic and material spiritual vision where gods are not shut off from humans in a separate ontological sphere and where divinity was not essentially different from humanity. It is to be attentive to the imminence of sacred revelations in the flesh, not simply those that come from outside nature in the shape of words. It is to recognize that we are participants in nature's sacred evolution, even as we productively carve out a time and place for ourselves within nature by means of technology, including technologies of the word. Technology is a tragic, if necessary, aspect of our human condition. The tragedy of technology is it temporarily differentiates its users from the rest of nature. It punctuates our relationship to nature, making the remainder of living energetic matter appear as if nothing but a context or an environment for who we are and what we do. Language, the technology of words, plays a part. From the technological perspective of words, nature becomes a referent, something outside us, a thing toward which our language points or directs attention. To declare, in the beginning was the Word, is to tragically misunderstand living energetic matter of which we are a part. It is to recognize energetic matters, but only from the perspective of information, only from the perspective of technologically coded variety. This is a tragedy, I think, that could be called the tragedy of ontotheology. But really beyond words, there is a matrix that is a material realm in which we are part that is more real to us than what words give us, more fleshy and more varied. This means that technology, no matter how artificial, no matter how tragic, is never itself really outside nature. No parasite is. No parasite exists independent of its host. No technology exists independent of the energetic matter upon which it depends. And this is true for the Left Behind books as well. And just as well as them, it's true for the Bible, the God-given text that inspires these authors of the Word. In the unfolding of this dance, the Word may play a leading role. And I think, really, linguistic capability is part of our nature. The Word may play a leading role, but it never comes first, nor does it have the final say. The Word may periodically banish the serpent, but the serpent returns to devour the Word. Or better yet, the serpent returns to make the Word laugh. Pushed aside are whole other planes of sacred technological imaginings of the body. Imaginings that are at once more intimate and imminent, charming and joyful, Christian and otherwise. The technological transcendence of LaHaye and Jenkins asks us to see the world with prophetic eyes cast upward to heaven and to read the world's actual histories as signs of end times to come. By contrast, I conclude this talk with a meditation on apocalyptic dangers prepared by members of the Iroquois Nation and presented to the United Nations Conference on Indigenous Peoples. This meditation approaches the question of technology with animated spirituality and reverence for living energetic matter. It's called A Basic Call to Consciousness, a document that warns us about what is really being left behind as Christian prophecy believers and their political adherents in the United States prepare for the rapture. So I end with this text, A Basic Call to Consciousness by the Iroquois peoples. In the beginning, we are told that human beings who walk about on the earth have been provided with all things necessary for life. We were instructed to carry a love for one another and to show great respect for all beings on the earth. We were shown that our life exists with the tree life, and that our well-being depends on the well-being of vegetable life, and that we are close to four-legged beings as well. They are our relatives. The original instructions direct us who walk about on earth to treat the earth with great respect, to show affection and gratitude, to support and create life. When people cease to respect and express gratitude for these many things, then all of life will be destroyed and human life on this planet will come to an end. The Indo-European peoples who have colonized our own lands have shown very little respect for the things that create and support life. We believe these people have long ago in history lost touch. A way of life known as Western civilization is now on a death path, which its own culture has no viable answers for. Majority of the world's population does not find its root in Western culture or religion. The majority of the world finds its root in the natural world, and our traditions of the natural world must prevail. The majority of our people still live in accordance with the traditions which find their roots in Mother Earth. We must all become conscious and continually challenge every model, every program, every technological process that the West tries to force on us. The people who are living on this planet need to break from a very narrow concept of human liberation and begin to see liberation as something that needs to be extended to the natural world. What is needed is the liberation of all things that support life, air, water, trees, all things that support the sacred matrix of life. Thank you.